Psalm 62 this morning, if you have a Bible and would like to turn there. Psalm 62. We were in Psalm 42 and 43 last week, and now Psalm 62 here this morning. Someone once suggested that an average person's anxiety is focused on the following. Things that will never happen, events from the past that cannot be changed, criticism from other people, actually, so much of that actually being untrue. Health, which tends to get worse with stress. But very little anxiety relates to real and current problems. That's not to say that it doesn't relate to real and current problems. It's just often much of our anxiety relates to things that aren't necessarily real or current. Many people, though, struggle regularly with anxiety. I think in many ways it's like a hungry lion. It ravishes hordes of people. I mean, just going around and devouring people. And some people seek to conceal it out of fear that other people will stigmatize them. This is somehow embarrassing to me. I don't want people to know that I'm struggling with this. I don't want people to think less of me. But most of us know something of its bite. Most of us know something of its sting. We can relate to it. And you may be wrestling with it right now or off and on or repeatedly in your life. Anxiety cripples people. It causes them to scurry around frantically like ants looking for rest for their souls, especially after cruel people and cruel circumstances have victimized them. King David was such a victim, and he was looking for rest. Psalm 62 tells us a bit of his story and what was going on in his life, and he's going to express to us here in Psalm 62 that he found rest, for his soul, and you can find it too. God is anxiety's only cure. You must trust in Him alone. So let's look at Psalm 62. I want to read through this entire psalm as we get into it here this morning. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. From Him comes my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. How long will all of you attack a man to batter him like a leaning wall, a tottering fence? They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence. For my hope is from Him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory. My mighty rock, my refuge is God. Trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us. Those of low estate are but a breath. Those of high estate are a delusion. In the balances they go up. They are together lighter than a breath. Put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. Once God has spoken, twice have I heard this, that power belongs to God. And that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love, for you will render to a man according to his work. King David wrote this psalm at a time when cruel people and cruel circumstances bullied him and literally sought to stamp him out, to remove him from his throne and to do away with him. He had every reason to be anxious. And yet, while he has every reason to be anxious, this song that he sings in Psalm 62 is actually a song of confidence. And that song is rooted in nothing less than the character of God. His song does not match his circumstances at all. His circumstances are terrible. And yet his song soars high, high above them. Because David chose to trust in God alone. And he uses that word only or alone 6 times in the original language of this text to express his singular trust in God. David says, if I'm going to trust anything, if I'm going to find quietness for my soul anywhere, it's going to be in God. And this theme is the very heart of this text that we're looking at. Like David, you must trust in God alone. And so we're going to look this morning at 4 reasons to do that very thing, to trust in God alone. So we begin with the first reason, and that is this: your perpetual problems plague you. Isn't that reason enough to trust in God alone? You have problems. Isn't that why you're anxious in the first place? You have a definite or a potential problem, and the outcome of which is uncertainty. You don't know how it's going to pan out. And that outcome is unknown and troubling to you. And this was the case for David. Look down at verses 3 and 4. I think that we will see that here in these verses. He says, "How long will all of you," he's referring to his enemies, "how long will all of you attack a man?" That's David. "How long will all of you attack a man to batter him?" And he describes himself like a leaning wall, a tottering fence. They, David's enemies, only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. You might be anxious, like David was tempted to be, because you can't understand your problems. It's all of the unknowns that leave you biting at your fingernails and wanting to pull out your hair. It's very likely that you don't know the duration of your problems. And David's expressing that he does not know the duration of his problems. In verse 3, David said to his enemies, "How long will all of you attack a man to batter him?" David wondered how long all of his enemies were going to keep bullying him, keep trying to keep him off of his throne, and try to kill him. And so you may have questions like this: how long is this going to continue? How long will this court case drag on and on and on? How long will this sickness endure? How long am I going to have this boss? I didn't pick this boss. This is who I got. And how long am I going to have to put up with him, or this coworker, or this job? How long am I going to have to wait to get married? Is it going to be 1 year? Is it going to be 5? Is it going to be 10? How long will I be unemployed? How long will this be the case or that be the case? You have these nagging questions of how long, how long, how long, and frankly, you don't know. The unknown duration of your problems drives you nuts. But it's more than just not knowing the duration of your problems. You don't know the culmination of your problems. You don't know how they're going to end. You simply don't know. You don't have the answers to that. You don't have a crystal ball. You can't look down in the quarters of time and just see what's going to happen. David couldn't do that either. Notice how David describes himself while under enemy attack. He uses this very, very vivid imagery in verse 3. He describes himself like a leaning wall and a tottering fence. You ever feel that way? I mean, he's like a wall that's just about to topple over, a fence that's just on its last leg, just about to come down. Just one more push, his enemies were saying, and he will come crashing down. Push harder, push harder, push harder. He can't make it much longer. And like David, you may be wondering how things are going to end. You may feel like a leaning wall and a tottering fence. Will it end well, or will it end terribly? Will treatment eliminate the cancer, or will cancer eliminate me? In my workplace, are they going to overlook that mistake? I mean, I did make a mistake. Or will they fire me? Will the budget line up, or will I be short? Will they shut us down, or will they leave us alone? Will I pass, or will I fail? Will that flight go smoothly, or will it crash? Will my kids or my friends be okay? I mean, you may go, I just worry about my kids. I worry about the fact that they want to hang out with this person or that person. I'm concerned for them. Will this relationship continue, or will it fall apart? I mean, the list could go on and on forever for all of us. I mean, this huge list. How are all these things going to pan out? And the fact of the matter is, you don't understand your problems. And further, you can't withstand your problems. Your problems are bigger than you can handle. You are weak and vulnerable, and the sooner you and I figure that out, the better. You are like a leaning wall and a tottering fence. You are so, so insufficient for your problems. And meanwhile, your problems are cruel and ruthless. Look at verse 4 again. David, he refers to his problems here as his enemies. He says they only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They don't have good plans for him. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. David's oppressors were spreading lies about him. They were gossiping about him. They were flattering to him to his face. And meanwhile, behind his back, they were slandering him and speaking evil of him in private. They were a bunch of hypocrites. And your problems, whether they be people with faces or they be situations and circumstances, they are often cruel and ruthless, and you are incapable of dealing with them yourselves. They will break you down. I want you to imagine with me that it's New Year's Eve. That's probably not too hard to imagine this time of year because we were just there. I want you to imagine it's New Year's Eve. You're going to invite all your friends and family over to your house. You're going to stay up till midnight, eat a lot of food, nothing but the healthiest of food, of course, as we all do on Christmas Eve. Just veggies, right? Nothing fried. No, you bring out all the junk food. I mean, you're just going to have a blast with all your friends and family. And they all come over, and you've been hanging out, talking, and you decide, okay, we need some games. So you go down to your basement, you walk by your washer, your dryer, your hot water tank, all your appliances, you go to get those games. And you go to the game closet, wherever you keep those things, and as you're walking to that closet, you notice a foul, foul smell as you walk right by all your appliances, and you think, wow, like my kids smell horrible. Like my daughter's socks or my son's shoes, like that is foul, just a rotten egg, nasty, nasty smell. Okay, well, I'm going to get these games, and I'm going to get upstairs. And so you go to your game closet, and you find Settlers of Catan. You know, a lot of people are addicted to that. And there's always Monopoly because somebody wants a long, painful, slow death at the hand of cruel property owners. I found out as a youth pastor about some games like Killer Bunnies and Exploding Kittens from junior high guys. Those games are real. So you grab all these. Everybody's going to have a blast. And you walk right by your appliances again, and you go, whoa, man, that is horrible. And it dawns on you that that's not your daughter's socks. That's not your son's shoes. That rotten egg smell is gas, and it's potent. I mean, you're getting like a killer headache, and you realize, I think this has been leaking for a long time. This isn't a small leak. And you're trying to figure out what's going on. And this is really, really bad. What do? You run to your closet, and you whip out your duct tape, and you try to find that leak, and you tape it up really tight and on your way. That'd be stupid. Right? I mean, you're not sure where the leak's at, and it's significant. And your house is packed with people. You run upstairs and you go, hey guys, I don't know what's going on, but I got a gas leak. I need you all to get out of here. I don't think it's safe in my house right now. You hop on the phone, you call perhaps 911, maybe more likely an ATCO gas or something like that. You pick up the phone, you call them, you want them out there looking at that problem and getting it fixed. You're not trying to fix that yourself because you look at yourself and you go, I'm not the person to fix this problem. This problem is beyond me. I can't even identify where the leak's coming from. Shouldn't our response to anxiety-producing situations be the same way? Shouldn't we immediately run to God? I mean, if that gas leak happens in your house, you immediately go, this isn't me. Like, I can't deal with this. Well, shouldn't, when anxiety-producing situations come to your life, you're immediately, God, I can't deal with this. I need you. And you immediately run to Him. Because your perpetual problems plague you, you must trust in God alone. Acknowledge that you are insufficient for your problems. And if you are going to find rest for your soul, it's essential for you to come to grips with this fact and run to God. This is too much for me. Stop trying to fix everything. You can't. I want to move on to a second reason to trust in God alone. Your personal God gives aid. Look at verses 1 and 2. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. From Him comes my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. David declares in verse 1, for God alone, my soul waits in silence. In the midst of chaos, the disposition of his soul is one of calmness and composure. And he explains why. And if he could summarize it, he's saying it this way, God's my refuge. And this refuge theme actually dominates both verses 1 and 2 and then verses 5 down through verse 7. Both sets of verses, if you kind of cast your eyes over verses 1 and 2 and then verses 5 to 7, you'll see that they are strikingly, strikingly similar. In fact, verses 2 and verse 6 are almost identical. In these two sets of verses, David uses the personal pronoun my 12 times to communicate the personal nature of God's protection. Your personal God gives aid. He is, first of all, your deliverer. David refers to God as my salvation 3 times. You see that if you look down at verse 1, at the end of the verse, from Him comes my salvation. If you look down at verse 6, He is only my rock and my salvation. And then verse 7, on God rests my salvation. In the Old Testament, when you see that word salvation, it typically carries the idea of deliverance. And you must say with David, God is my salvation. God is my deliverer. But he's more than your deliverer. He is your defender. David goes on to heap up image after image to convey that God was his protector. And he refers to God as his rock. We see that three times. Look at verse 2. He only is my rock. Verse 6. He only is my rock. And then verse 7. My mighty rock. And then he talks about God as his fortress. And he uses that imagery two times. You see it in verse 2. He says, my fortress. Down in verse 6, my fortress. And the other way he refers to God is as his refuge. Two times. We see it in verse 7. At the end of the verse, he says, my refuge is God. And then down in verse 8, I love this simple statement here. God is a refuge for us. David was an ancient warrior who lived on the battlefield. You read the Old Testament, that's where you see David a lot of the time. And David is using images that are familiar to him on the battlefield to describe God's protection and security. He's saying, God is to me like a personal fortress. David said in verse 2, I shall not be greatly shaken. Because God offers his aid, you can live a life free from anxiety. Several years ago, my wife and I, within the span of a couple months, went to two different homes for dinner of some of our friends, and they wanted to show us what they had in their backyard. And the first home we went to, our friends said, hey, we want to show you, we've got this bomb shelter in the backyard. I'm like, really? You have a bomb? Who has a bomb shelter? You have your personal own bomb shelter? Well, that's kind of cool. So they take us, probably from the World War II era or something like that. Just huge, thick concrete walls. It was, I think most of it was above ground, but you could walk in and there was storage space for food and bunks and it's like right in their backyard. And I thought, why do you have this? Like, nobody's bombing around here, and I don't think anybody ever bombed this area, but that's cool. You'll be ready to go in case someone does. And then we went over to some other friends of ours, and they wanted to show us what they had in their backyard. They had basically taken a backhoe and dug this big hole, and there's these one-piece units that you just plop in the ground. They've got this big hatch, stairs to go down into it. You can store your food in it. It's like end of the world. So if you're one of these end of the world terrified people, you probably need one of these. But they had one. And they were showing it. I was like, actually, it is kind of cool. I mean, even in a tornado or something like that, it'd be really practical. And I think what David is doing when he uses this imagery of fortress, he's using an ancient image. But I think we could bring that image into the modern era if we think about something like a bomb shelter. You go back to the World War II era. And maybe where you're living, I mean, every day, air raid after air raid after air raid, airplane after airplane after airplane, bomb after bomb after bomb. And the sirens go off, the lights go out, and you go into your bomb shelter. And you're in that bomb shelter. You can't see what's going on outside of that bomb shelter, but you're hearing bombs drop, bombs go off. Maybe your house just went kaboom. I mean, it is absolute chaos outside of that shelter. And David is saying, God is like that shelter to me. My life may be total chaos. It may be total pandemonium. It may be a complete disaster. But I run to God, and there's this place of quietness and safety and security and calmness. Your personal God gives aid. You must trust in him alone. Remind yourself often that he is a fortress. And don't just remind yourself of that. Run to him. I'm going to run to God as my shelter, as my fortress. Moving on to a third reason here to trust in God alone. I think this is so important that we grasp this third one. Your comical alternatives prove vain. I want to ask you, what's the very best thing you have up your sleeve? What's your very best plan? You realize that everything up your sleeve is a joke. If it's not God, it's worthless. In verse 8, David summons us to trust in him at all times. God's a refuge for us. And that reality makes trusting in anything else foolish. And he's going to go on to articulate some of the different things that we're prone to turn to, some of the different man-made fortresses, so to speak, that we could run to and seek to find rest and security and calmness from our anxiety. We trust the Lord because it doesn't make sense to trust anything else. In verses 9 to 10, David's going to give us some of these comical alternatives that we're prone to turn to. So let's look at these. In verse 9, the first thing that he highlights is the might of men. And David's point, God's point, is that the might of men is worthless. Look at verse 9. He says, those of low estate are but a breath. Those of high estate are a delusion. And the balances, they go up. They're together lighter than a breath. What happens when you're anxious? What happens when there are all these unknowns and you have problems? If you're like me, and probably pretty much everybody I think would be in this boat, one of the first things we do is, okay, I have this problem, so who can fix it? Who can I run to? You think, well, the doctor, the bank, my friends, my family, who can fix my problems? And we immediately are tempted to run to man and put our trust in him. And obviously, people have their place in our life. But God is saying, in your battle against anxiety, they are not the ultimate answer. Whether they are everyday men, men lowly in rank, or whether they are men of great position and prominence and power, they're ultimately not the answer. In fact, David's going to use, I think, this really cool picture to put this all in perspective. The picture that he uses is that of an ancient scale. Okay, so you've seen this. You basically have two sides of it. And David says, here's how it works. You put men on one side of the scale, and what happens? As soon as you put men on that side of the scale, their side of the scale immediately goes straight up. And David's point is, they're lighter than air. The air on the other side of the scale weighs more than them. They're not the answer. Don't put your trust in the might of men. The might of men is worthless. And then he turns our attention to the methods of men and tells us that the methods of men are likewise worthless. Look at verse 10. Put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. God warns, don't trust the methods of men. And he names two in particular, oppression and robbery. Oppression, or we might say extortion, is the acts, as one person has said, it's acts of abuse of power or authority, the burdening, trampling, or crushing of those lower in station. And then he talks about robbery. And robbery here, this word that's used in the original language, is not just going and taking something from somebody, but doing so with violence. And these two things, I think, are precisely what David's enemies were using. That's how they were seeming to get ahead, right? They're oppressing him. They're robbing him. And it's working. And so what's the temptation? Well, if you're going to fight that way, then I'll fight that way. If you're going to bully me this way, you're going to make my life difficult. You're going to make me anxious. Well, I can play that game too. What's God saying? When people and circumstances are cruel, don't trust your ability to throw your weight around. David had a lot of weight to throw around. I mean, he may have been booted from his throne. These guys may have got him off of it. But he was the highest person in all the kingdom. You think he didn't have friends? You think he didn't have power? Even as he was fleeing? I mean, if David wanted to throw his weight around, I think he could have found a way to do it. So what's God saying to you? Don't retaliate with evil. Don't turn to things like gossip, slander, mudslinging, and evil actions. Those are the methods of men. And they're worthless. And they are a dead-end street. Rather be gracious. That's not the way you deal with your problems. The might of men is worthless. The methods of men. And then thirdly here, the money of men is worthless. Look at verse 10. Last phrase. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. Obviously, we know money has a place in life, right? But Proverbs 23 verse 5 warns that riches have a way of making themselves wings and flying away. They're there today, they're gone tomorrow. Even when you try sometimes to be super wise with your money, riches have a way of making themselves wings and flying away. Wealth isn't the answer. So I just want to ask you some questions. What are you banking on right now? Okay, you figure out what's going on in your life that you're anxious about. How are you trying to fix that? Are you banking on the arm of man? You're saying, I know I'm sick, but this doctor is the best doctor in all of Edmonton and all of Alberta and all of Canada. I've got the very best one. That's awesome. But is that what you're relying on? And they go, well, I'm out of work right now. But the great thing is that my wife and I have worked really, really hard to establish 6 to 8 months of an emergency fund. And so, and I'm young and I'm hardworking and I think this is all going to work out okay. I mean, just ask the question, you are anxious. What are you doing about that? Who are you hoping in? At the end of the day, the arm of man, your bank account, some person is ultimately not the answer. At the age of 39, a man by the name of John Knight, who was a successful engineer, he stepped out onto the second floor balcony of his $1.4 million home. You hear that number, you go, that must have been a pretty nice house. And he leaned up against the railing of that balcony, which is presumably looked just fine. And what he didn't realize was that that railing was rotten, probably on the inside, behind the paint. And when he leaned his weight up against it, it gave out and it sent John plummeting to his death. And I think that's sort of what God is warning us against here. You're going to lean all your weight on something. You're going to run somewhere. You're going to put all of your weight somewhere. And you better make sure you put it in the right place, because if you run to the arm of man, you run to the might and the methods of men and the money of men, you're putting all your weight, you're leaning everything up against something that God never intended to meet your needs in the ultimate sense. And when you do that, you put all your weight up against it, you're going to end off worse off than you started. Like this man named John Knight who came crashing to his death. Your comical alternatives to trusting in God alone are unable to support you. They may look good, they may appear to be reliable, but they are not. They may be a part of God's plan to help you, but they are not the ultimate answer. Because your comical alternatives prove vain, you must trust in God alone. So I challenge you, watch out for false substitutes. Watch out for false fortresses for trust, because they are inadequate platforms on which to place your confidence. Fourth reason to trust in God alone, and I think this is really going to get to the heart of our faith here. Your reliable God speaks truth. Look at verses 11 and 12. David says, once God has spoken, twice I have heard it. So what he's saying is God has spoken and now I've got the point. What has God said? Once God has spoken, twice have I heard this, that power belongs to God. And that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. For you will render to a man according to his work. God has spoken and he has told you what he is like. And the question is, will you take God at his word and will you take his word to the bank and choose to trust him based on what he has said? Will you take him at his word? So what has God said? If God has spoken and God has said something to you that will help you in situations in which you are prone to be anxious, what has God said? What has God said about himself to you? Well, here's what he said. First of all, he declares himself powerful. Verse 11 says that power belongs to God. As David looked around, where do you think he saw power? Well, probably in the hands of his enemies. But power, God says, belongs to him. God's power far surpasses the power of your foes, whether they be people, whether they be problems or circumstances or situations. God is greater than them all. And yet God has said more. He said more than just than he's powerful. And in fact, if that's all he says, I think as a human being, I am absolutely horrified. Whoa, you've got God and he is full of power. That's it? I'm scared of that God. He declares himself powerful, but he also declares himself loving. Verse 12 says, to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love. That phrase there, steadfast love, is translated various ways in different translations. Sometimes it's translated mercy or loving loyalty. But this is God's covenant, loving loyalty to his people. And it has a promise dynamic in it. It's God's love with a promise, with God's faithfulness behind it. God has promised his love and he will prove it. God declares himself powerful, he declares himself loving, and he declares himself just. Look at the second half of verse 12. For you, referring to God, will render to a man according to his work. What's the point? The point is that God is just, and the point is that God is fair. God's justice is a two-edged sword. He guarantees that unjust men will get what they deserve. God's going to render to those men what they deserve. And he's also going to take care of you, his child. Relief from anxiety hinges on the belief in a powerful God who keeps his promises and who exercises justice for those who walk uprightly. Faith, we might say, is the key that unlocks the door to rest. Many of you are familiar with George Mueller. He ran orphanages for children. He's been known for his prayer life. George Mueller said this. I really love this. He said, "The beginning of anxiety is the end of faith." Not talking about you losing your salvation. Not saying if you're anxious, you're unsaved. No. That's not what he's saying. He's saying the beginning of anxiety is in the end of faith. Basically, faith and anxiety don't really simultaneously exist very well. The beginning of anxiety is the end of faith, and the beginning of faith is the end of anxiety. So in other words, as we look at this text and God says, "I'm powerful, I love you, and I'm fair and I'm just," when I choose to take God at his word, my anxiety begins to trickle away. Your reliable God speaks truth, and you must trust in him alone. Lean on him. Verse 8, I think, makes this all-encompassing statement. It says, "Trust in him at all times." I don't know about you, read that, I was like, that's a huge statement. And I know I have every reason to trust in God alone, and I know theoretically in every circumstance I have every reason to trust in God alone, but I find that difficult. How do I do that? And what I want to do is just give you three tips here as we wrap up, or ways to trust in God alone from this text. I personally think these are gold. And the first way to trust in God alone, we looked at this idea last week in Psalm 42 and Psalm 43. The first way to trust in God alone is preach to your heart. One of the single greatest things you can ever learn to do as a Christian in your Christian life is to preach to yourself, as opposed to listening to your meandering thoughts go this way and that way. You tell yourself how and what to think. You preach to yourself who God is, what he is like, who he's pledged himself to be. And that's precisely what we see David doing. And I want to show you from the text that he's doing that. And then I want to show you the results of that in his life. You notice in verse 1, the very beginning of the psalm, David declares that his soul silently waits for God. He's sort of stating it as a fact. But in verse 5, you'll notice if you look at the wording carefully, he says, "For God alone, O my soul," and now he preaches to himself. He says, "Wait. Wait in silence." Now all of a sudden, he's grabbed himself by the lapels and he said, "All right, self, here's the message you need to hear. Wait for God." What are the results of that? Well, in verse 1, he's just stated this fact that his soul finds rest in God alone. And if you compare verses 2 to the end of verse 6, you'll see the results. So look at verse 2. He says at the end of verse 2, after stating that his soul waits in silence for God, he says, "I shall not be greatly shaken." Okay, my soul is not going to be tossed to and fro. Like, I'm going to have equilibrium in my soul here. But notice what happens in verse 6 after he preaches to himself. The wording changes just ever so slightly. At the end of verse 6, he says, "I shall not be," he doesn't say, "I shall not be greatly shaken." He says, "I shall not be shaken at all." His confidence grows as he preaches to himself. And the end verse is also true. What happens when you stop preaching to yourself? What happens when you stop telling yourself, "Self, listen up. Here's who God is. Here's who God has pledged himself to be." What happens when you let your thoughts just start going and you don't take them captive and preach the truth to yourself? I would compare it a lot to rowing upstream. Many of you, I would imagine, have hopped in a kayak or a canoe, maybe with a friend, and you were canoeing down a river and you said, "Hey, why don't we try to go the other way? Let's go upstream. Let's see how far we can make it." You put your paddles in the water and you start paddling upstream. You're not going anywhere fast, but you're going forward. You can make progress against that current. What happens as soon as you take your paddles and you put them back in the canoe? Where's your boat going to go? Well, it's going to go straight down that river wherever the current wants to take you. And as soon as you stop preaching to yourself, that's precisely what happens. Anxiety takes over, and it's going to take you this way. It's going to take you that way. It's going to take you wherever it wants to take you, and it's going to take you on a terrible ride. Preach to your heart. The second way to trust in God alone is this. Pour out your heart. Look at verse 8. Trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before Him. God's a refuge for us. What's on your heart? Maybe nobody knows about it. Have you given it to God? Have you taken all that's on your heart and all that's on your shoulders and said, God, here you go. Here it all is. I'm worried about this. I'm anxious about this. This is driving me nuts. God, help. Here it all is. I can't deal with it. And you may need to do that again and again and again, because you could do that today. I mean, you just unburden yourself. You pour out your heart to God and you wake up tomorrow morning and you pick it right back up and it's on your shoulders again. No, okay, I put it on my shoulders. Here you go again, God. I'm just going to pour out my heart to you in prayer. I'm going to talk to you about all these things. I'm going to give it to you. The degree to which you pour out your heart to God reveals the precise measure of your trust in Him. Open your heart to God. Tell Him everything. Be honest, and guess what? He can handle it. Third and final way to trust in God alone that I think we see in this text very simply is this. Put up your feet. You preach to your heart, you pour out your heart, and you put up your feet. I think when I say that, we immediately think of passages like Ephesians chapter 6. Well, Pastor Nate, I'm in a war, I thought, in a battle. Like, I can't just put up my feet. If God's word implies or teaches you that you should do something, then by all means do it. And if it tells you to go out and fight Goliath, then by all means you go out and you fight Goliath. But after doing those things prescribed in God's word, you put up your feet. You realize that you can't be God. You can't play God. You can't do the things God can do. The only thing you can do is do what God told you to do. The only thing you can do is obey. You're not God. You don't rule and reign from the heavens like He does. You preach to your heart, you pour out your heart, you obey what God says in His word, but then you put your feet up and you sit back and you watch God do what only God can do. Leave it up to Him to do His work. Kick up your feet and watch God do what only He can do. Verse 5, David preached to himself. He said, "For God alone, O my soul, wait how? In silence." He's waiting on God to do what only God can do. For my hope is from Him. Because God is your only hope, you must trust in Him alone. David maintained peace and calmness of soul by attacking anxiety God's way. Are you attacking it God's way? Will you do the same by choosing to trust in God alone? I'd invite you now, if you would, to bow your head and close your eyes. I want to give you just a little bit of time to talk to the Lord yourself here this morning.